or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Coming up later in the show, should you start a one-person business? So many people, either because they're forced to, because they can't find a job, or they've long wanted to, contemplate starting a business. But as we all know, lots of businesses fail. But how about you? Should you? I've come up with 14 questions that I've learned over the really 4,000 clients in the last over 26 years that have kind of helped differentiate the successful from the unsuccessful one or few person entrepreneur. And I will ask you those 14 questions a little later in the show. And if we have time, I've come up with another one. I was kind of on a roll with creating these kind of quizzes or inventories or whatever. And the other one is, how much is your procrastination hurting you? For some people, you can procrastinate and do just fine. John Perry, the guy who just hosts a philosophy talk right before this show, wrote a book on that. You can procrastinate and still do okay. And some people can, but a lot of people can't. I will ask you five questions to help you self-assess the extent to which your procrastination needs fixing. But first, this seems like an absurd question. What's the best career? The obvious answer is the best career for one person is the worst career for somebody else. And yet I was charged, U.S. News charged me with the task of coming up with its best careers list. So what the heck was I going to do? Well, I looked, at the job market. I looked at pay. I looked at prestige. I also looked at how psychologically rewarding, how good for the world, how much benefit you do. And I created this scoring system, and I rated about 500-some-odd careers. So while it is true, certainly, that the best career for one person is the worst career for somebody else, the career that scored overall highest was optometrist. And so I thought, I have been remiss on this show, Work with Marty Nemko, for in 24 years now. I have never done a show. I've done a lot of shows on what's it really like to be anything from a psychiatrist to a prostitute, but I've never done what's it really like to be an optometrist. Well, I'm going to remedy that this morning. Perhaps you or someone you love might be interested in such a career, or you might simply find it fascinating to see what goes on behind the refractor. Is it better with lens one or lens two? With me is my own optometrist. The guy, and he's not just, I didn't just bring him in because he's mine, although I did choose him very carefully, but he was also recommended by the UC School of Optometry as a great guy to have on the show. So it is my pleasure to introduce, and his father was my optometrist way back when, Mort Sarver. So Larry Sarver, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you for inviting me.
My pleasure. So what might surprise an educated person about what it's really like to be an optometrist?
Well, I would say it's both fun and stressful. Hmm. It's fun because especially when you've been at it for a long time, you get to see patients year after year, and they become like your friends. So you get to catch up with them, find out how their kids are, what's going on with their lives. So that's the fun part of it. But the stressful part is we do, with today's economy, we need to see patient after patient after patient. So whereas we used to be able to spend 45 minutes to an hour with a patient, we got to turn them over every 20 to 30 minutes. So we don't want our patients to think we're not interested in them, but we do need to move on from patient to patient and get everything done and entertain them and inform them and diagnose them, but keep things moving.
Actually, one of the reasons I scored optometry high, because relative to many other jobs, I perceived it, again, from reading and talking to some folks, as being low stress because, A, you have quite high success rate. A large percentage of people come in and they need new glasses, new contact lenses, they've got dry eyes or whatever, you give them drops, you give this or that, that you have a relatively high success rate. You don't work nights and weekends. There aren't very few emergency in the middle of the night optometry calls. If you were to be put on your statesman hat and look circumspectly at the range of careers, would you consider your career above average in stress or no?
No, I would say you're right. It's probably below average in stress. But one thing that might surprise a lot of people is that a lot of optometrists do, because of our daily movements, reaching and turning and all that sort of thing. A lot of optometrists get neck, back, hip, shoulder injuries.
I could see where dentists would, because they're leaning over a patient for a long time, but you're basically, you know, playing with a refractor and you're standing over it and you're not really... What do you think is the cause of that?
It's just the slow, repetitive motion day after day, patient after patient of doing it.
Interesting. Anything else might surprise me about what it's really like to be an optometrist?
I think a lot of people don't know that the range of what different optometrists do can vary from optometrist to optometrist. Some just do refractions for glasses and contacts, but a lot of optometrists do prescribe medications for conjunctivitis and are even doing glaucoma treatment now. And so there's a wide variety of what we do.
I know that there are also low vision specialists, and I would think that would not have a high success rate. That's a difficult one, am I correct?
That is very difficult. And that would be a stressful part of what we do. Patients come in hoping that you can help them, and you can help them, but usually not to the extent that they want to be helped.
Let's explain, by the way, low vision. I mean, anybody who needs glasses essentially has low vision, but that's not what we're referring to here. Right. What are we referring to here with low
vision?
Because
a lot of people think, oh, I'm really nearsighted, I need these thick glasses, I have low vision, but that's not true. Most people can be corrected to a level that allows them to function quite well. Low vision means that the best a person can see with their best eye is 2200, which isn't very good.
That's the E on the eye chart. That's the big letter.
It's pretty close to that, yeah. And then on top of that, most of these people also have reduced peripheral vision, reduced depth perception, other visual functions that don't work very well.
So what, you know, the obvious thing that makes, you know, it makes sense to what you do there, you give them magnifying glasses to make increase the size of the images. Is that really the main thing you do, or is there something else you do?
Well, traditionally, low vision experts do use telescopic systems and magnifying systems. But there's a lot of new things coming out, new technological advances with closed-circuit TVs.
Give me one example. Flesh one of those out for me. What's a modern tool that is used to help people who can't be corrected with glasses and can only see as much as the E on the eye chart and have crappy peripheral vision?
I'm not an expert on this, but I understand the iPad has an app for low-vision patients to be able to read.
Okay, let's go off that, and let's, you know, one of the things that we all of us who choose doctors or lawyers or accountants or optometrists, degrees don't guarantee quality of clinical care by a long shot. And in some ways, the more prestigious the degree, the more likely it is to be research and theory oriented rather than clinically fabulous. So first, let's define, what defines the difference between a clinically good optometrist versus one who simply reads the number off of the auto-refractor machine or, you know, is just a human computer?
Right. Most optometrists can do the eye exam and prescribe, but really what separates apart is listening to patients, communicating with them, following through with them, and help making sure they understand what you can and can't do for them, taking the time to do that.
So give me an example of where listening and creating a space during that 20 to 25 minutes that's open enough that a person might reveal something important that he might not otherwise, or she might not.
One thing that comes to mind is cataracts are a very common disorder of the eyes. Patient comes in and says, I'm having trouble reading, I'm bothered by light and glare, I want you to make my glasses better so that I can see what I'm doing. And then through the process of the exam and dilating the patient, it becomes very obvious that they're developing cataracts. So you got to spend 10, 15 minutes talking to them about what's going on, why you can't correct it, what's going to happen, when, you know, whether we're going to follow up, and when they're going to need cataract surgery and how that's going to work.
Mm-hmm. And where is, you know, it's one thing to talk and explain the procedure and the probabilities or whatever. Where does the real art of getting, let's say you know you really want to kind of get the person open to the idea of having the cataract surgery, where does the art come in?
Well, that's just in having worked with patients like this over and over and just in the process of the exam, getting a read on the patient.
I'm going to interrupt you. Let's say I said I'm scared. You tell me I need the surgery, and I'm scared. I'm scared it won't work. I'm scared it'll hurt. I'm scared it's going to, you know, the follow-up. I'm scared. and I will, knowing I'm making this up, I know I'll procrastinate, and then it'll be harder because the surgery, the clouding is going to get greater. In the meantime, I'm also going to suffer. I'm going to have bad vision for a longer time, and I'm scared. How would you deal with me as a patient?
Oh, I'm going to schedule you to come in every year. Generally speaking, cataracts develop very slowly, and we're going to talk you through it as it happens. And we have some excellent cataract surgeons that we work with. The percentage of success is not only good, but oftentimes the vision after cataract surgery is better than the vision that you've had in a long, long time.
Okay. All right. Let's talk also about the, you know, people are, especially if you're not 17, you're 18 years old, you could say, okay, I'll go to one of those seven-year combined bachelor's and OD, optometry doctor degrees. They're 30 or 40, and they don't have, even the 4 years for, they may have a bachelor's degree in liberal arts or whatever, and then they're going to have to take prerequisites and get into optometry school. What advice do you, let's say I'm intrigued by the idea of being an optometrist, and I'm 25, 30, 40, 50. Is it crazy for me to contemplate going back to school to be an optometrist? What way would you suggest I do it? Give me some guidance on the training thing.
Well, no, I think it's a good career. But I think, and from my perspective, anyone who's looking at, if you want to make a lot of money fast, that's not going to happen in optometry.
In almost any field these days, unfortunately.
Right. But it's very rewarding. Like I said, getting to know people and helping them year after year is well worth it. You don't usually have to take the work home with you at night, so you can have some free time. So
you know what I found interesting, Larry? I don't know if it's your personality or whatever. When I asked you that, you said it's a good career. You didn't say it was a great career. You didn't say it was wonderful. What's the real truth? Talk to me what goes on as you lie in bed at night. What really goes on?
I think it was a good career choice for me, but I don't know that I would sit here and actually tell people that it's something to get into right now. With all the changes going on in the health industry, we don't even know where optometry is going to be positioned in terms of Obamacare or healthcare. There's a lot of changes going on, and it's a little scary out there right now.
Give me your guess as to how the field you think will change under Obamacare and other factors that are changing things.
I think optometrists are going to have to go two ways. One is to continue to do what we do best, which is do refractions and contact lens fittings, and maybe do a lot of that privately, maybe with some health insurance, eye care insurance involved with that. But a lot of optometrists are needing to get into therapeutics, treating eye disease, doing glaucoma care. That's probably where the future for new optometrists is.
And is it also a factor? I've heard that that refraction is a fancy word basically for telling you what your prescription is for glasses or contact lenses, that that people who are far less trained will be licensed to do those refractions, so that would eat up a huge part of your business. Is that correct?
I think that's possible. I think opticians that are trained and are good at it should be able to do refractions, but I think patients need to know that that's all it is, and that sometimes you need, as I was explaining with the cataract patient, you need a full dilated exam to really do a proper eye exam and prescribe and advise the patient.
Okay. You know, one of the aspects that optometrists have moved, and you talked about, kind of more new specialties, certainly we now see billboards, radio commercials, whatever, for RK, various kind of laser treatments to replace the need for glasses. What, from an ethical standpoint, to what extent, I'll just ask you, what do you feel about that whole new industry, if you will?
Oh, first of all, no one does RK anymore.
Okay, forgive my ignorance. But laser,
that's okay.
Yeah, laser or whatever it is.
Laser technology is awesome. It's great. And in my office, in most optometry practices, we've embraced it. And it's been a great thing because it is new technology. Patients come in asking about it. And, a lot of people ask me when it first came out, boy, is this going to be really bad for your business? And it's actually been the opposite because it raises up interest in the whole profession. And people who've had it done, if you work with them and advise them and send them to a good surgeon, they come back because they want to preserve what's happened. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people once they understand what it can and can't do for them. Most people don't want to do laser surgery.
Right. Well, let's hear about that, because I had heard about that sometimes you don't get great vision and there are problems, etc. Tell me the truth about and it's ophthalmologists who do this surgery?
Ophthalmologists, right? Correct.
Not optometrists. And for folks who don't know the difference, ophthalmologists are MDs who specialize long after they do a residency, after they've completed their internship, in the diseases of the eye, and they're the only ones who are allowed to do major surgery. I think that optometrists, who have a 4-year degree after college typically, they are allowed to prescribe some medication and do some minor surgeries, but only the ophthalmologists are allowed to do laser surgery to correct vision. Is that an accurate statement?
In California, that is correct.
Okay. Other states?
And there are a few states that allow optometrists to do laser surgery.
Interesting. Yes. Is that wise, or is that the power of the optometry lobby? From a patient's ethical, cost-beneficial standpoint, is it ethical and wise for optometrists to be doing laser surgery?
I think it's ethical and wise. I think you just need to be good at it, whoever you are.
Okay.
And, yeah. So what was your original question? You lost me.
Right. Well, we were talking about laser surgery, pros and cons, you said.
All right. People need to understand what it can do. For a lot of people come in and they think once you've had laser surgery and you've had the correction, that's it. Your eyes aren't going to change. But that's hardly true. Our eyes continue to change. You need reading glasses. You can develop cataracts. So there is still a constant change. So what you're doing is re-zeroing your prescription. If you're really nearsighted, you're getting it close to zero. If you're really farsighted, you're getting it close to zero. But that doesn't mean that you're not going to need reading glasses or that you might need driving glasses.
So it's just like plastic surgery where, it can take 10 or 12 years off your life, but it's not going to stop you from aging. It just resets it, as you say, to zero where you were.
Right. Right.
Okay, let's spend the last couple of minutes looking afresh at the career itself. So if I were your brother, and I was, let's say, 40, 35, something in the middle, and I said to you, okay, I know you're worried about the future of the field, but I need you to give me a clear-eyed presentation of who's best suited for the career, what's the smartest way to go about it, how would you tell me, your brother, to go about, I don't need to get rich, but I want to make a nice middle-class living. What's your advice for me, Larry Sarver?
Well, first of all, you need good people skills. You need to like to talk to people and have the ability to read what's on people's mind and talk to them and help them through things. If you don't have that, then you're just going to be a clinical machine, and it's not going to be fun for you or the patient. I don't know. At the age of 40, I'm not sure it's something that I would start up. To be honest with you, I think there would be better, quicker, other interesting careers to get into at the age of 40.
What would Larry Sarver do if he were 20 now?
I would probably do it all over again.
Why?
I had the opportunity to work with my dad and my brother, and I mean, it was a good fit.
Let's say you didn't have the family connections.
Probably veterinary medicine or something along those lines.
Okay.
I always wanted to do that, but I'm allergic to dogs, so I had to be really careful about that, but that's probably something I'd really like to do.
Well, it certainly wasn't a rough time having you as a guest on my show. Larry Sarver, my optometrist, who I do recommend, he's a smart guy, good. He used some very good clinical judgment with me about when he noticed there was some drying on my eyelids. We won't bore you with all of that crap, but he's good. So Larry Sarver, he works in Rockridge Optometry, which is on College Avenue in Oakland. Larry Sarver, thanks very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco.
Thank you very much.
Good. And now, my dear listeners, I have an awkward question I have to ask you. Do you like this show? Do you like Work with Marty Nemco? Why am I asking? This is not just for feedback, although I always welcome your feedback. But if you do like it, and you can certainly continue to listen for free, but if you appreciate that Work with Marty Nemco is heard without commercials, then somebody's got to pay for it. And that's got to be you. I don't get paid, but this costs a lot of money to run a radio station. If you would like to pay your fair share and get a rather nice thank you gift, here's the deal. For $75, you can get a signed copy of my new book, How to Do Life, What They Didn't Teach You in School, and the good feeling of knowing you're paying your fair share to be a member of public, local public radio. But the real thing I'm excited about is if you can find your way to pay $150, not only is that 150 votes for work with Marty Nemko, which helps keep me on the air, because that's how they, in part, how they determine which shows stay on the air. It's which shows have listeners who are willing to support it financially. You can come to brunch with my wife, Dr. Barbara Nemko, and I, who is a frequent co-conspirator on this show. It'll be on Sunday, November 11th. You can come in and watch the show that morning at 11, watch Barbara and I go back and forth, scenes from a marriage. And afterwards, we have a nice brunch here at KALW, and it's a great networking opportunity. That's $150 for one person and $275 for two. For any of those reasons, if you would like to support work with Marty Nemko and public radio, the phone number, 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. And if you'd prefer to not talk to our friendly volunteers, you can go to kalw.org and make your pledge at any level. It only takes a minute. It's not too painful. There's all kinds of good reasons to do it. We're going to keep, by the way, I really want to keep these brief. I hate it when I listen to public radio and there are these long, disgusting pledge breaks where they're pitching. I don't want to do that. I respect you enough. So I'm going to cut it right off here. If you would like to support Work with Marty Nemko and public radio, enlightening the hearts and minds of the public. When you support public radio, you are enlightening the hearts and minds of the public pretty darn good and showing your support for Work with Marty Nemko at any level. If the basic membership's $50, $75, get your copy of How to Do Life, $150, come to brunch. It's very fun and great networking. 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917 or go to kalw.org. And now, as I promised at the top of the show, so many people are thinking about starting a business, either because they've long wanted to and they like the autonomy of it, or the concept of the autonomy of it. You're always still beholden to your customers, even though you can run the shots, you're only as good as your last hour. But also, unfortunately, in this economy, many people are forced into self-employment because they can't land a decent job or keep a decent job. And so, but they don't want scut work. They don't want to work wearing a yellow smock, smiley smock at Walmart. So they can go from schlepper to CEO in one fell swoop by running their own business. But on the other hand, we all know how many businesses start and fail. It varies with the individual. How likely are you to succeed? Now, normally, I would do this interactively with you and invite you to call in and do 3-minute career makeovers and discuss your situation. But because this is the really end of our pledge drive, this is the last show, you won't be hearing me asking for money until May, I can't take calls. So we're going to do, but I also care a lot about making this interactive for you, my dear listeners. So what I've done is I have created a 14-question kind of an inventory to ask you questions that will help you get a better sense of whether you're likely to succeed in self-employment. So if you or someone you love might be wanting to do it, or you're already in self-employment and wondering whether you should get out, you might want to take a piece of paper out and jot down these 14 questions. I'm going to ask you them slowly, one at a time, and either answer it for yourself or for someone you love who might be doing it, and see if it provides some insight for you. If not, it might simply be fun. Even if you have no desire to be self-employed, it might be fun to see how likely you would be to succeed in it. Okay, question number one. Running your own one-person... You don't have to write all this. That would be crazy. Just listen. Running your own one-person business means you must be a self-starter. You must structure your days by yourself and keep working hard, even in the face of setbacks. How confident are you that you would work hard and well enough? That's question one. How confident are you that you'd work hard and well enough? Very confident? Quite confident? Moderately confident? or minimally confident? Question two. In these, should you start your one-person business or a few-person business inventory here? Number two, how confident are you in the viability of your business concept or in your ability to find one? One of the keys to being a good entrepreneur is having good radar, keeping your antenna out for opportunities, people's pain points, businesses' pain points. Where is an unmet need? Where is the competition crappy? There's competition in every field, but where is the quality of that competition weak enough that perhaps you could step in? So I'll repeat the question again and give you the four choices. How confident are you in the viability of your business concept, when you already have, or in your ability to find a viable business concept? A, very. B, quite. C, moderate. D, minimally. My favorite example, by the way, of somebody who did that was a guy who was living in an apartment building, and he had to schlep his laundry to across the street or down the block or whatever it was to the laundromat because his apartment building didn't have a laundry in the building. So he went to the owner of the building, and he said, if I bought a washer and dryer, you've got a basement, you got a room there, will you, and I'll get bring it in for free. Yeah, you'll have to pay the electricity, but you'll have to do nothing. I'll maintain it. I'll provide this. I'll have the soap dispensers. I'll make my money by the coin operated. The owner said yes. He's done that like for dozens of apartment buildings now, and he simply drives around taking the money out of these laundry machines. That's an example of a pain point, being aware of a pain point that somebody has and converting it into a business. That's an example of that very often critical characteristic in the good entrepreneur. Question three on the should you start a one-person business inventory. By the way, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco, and I am giving you this little inventory that I've cooked up called Should You Start a One-Person Business? 14 questions. Question number three, how confident are you in your ability to create an excellent, if brief, business plan? It could be just a few pages that will address funding, how you'd get the money to start it, cash flow, how can you expect to get enough income in to keep from going broke, and critically, your marketing plan. I'll read it again. How confident are you in your ability to create an excellent, if brief, business plan that will address funding, cash flow, and marketing? Very confident, quite confident, moderately confident, or minimally confident? Question four. How confident are you in your ability to persuade people to buy, invest, sell to you, calm down customers? It's critical. The ability to persuade is critical. How confident are you in your ability to persuade people to buy, invest, for example, if you need money to start your business, to sell to you, vendors, you're trying to get a great vendor to sell to you, you have to be persuasive there too. How confident are you in your ability to calm down angry customers? Because no matter how good you are, there's going to be disgruntled customers, period. Very confident, quite confident, moderately confident, or minimally confident? Question five. This is a kind of a different format. If you were buying furniture for your business, would you mainly buy it A, used from a Craigslist ads or garage sales, things like that? B, used from a used furniture store? C, new from Office Depot, Target, IKEA, and so on? Or D, new from a higher-end furniture store? This one I need to kind of give you the kind of scoring key on this one. Generally, businesses go out of business for spending too much on stuff that's not central to the business. And the kind of person with a mindset to go and buy you stuff from Craigslist ads, asking good questions on the phone so you're not driving around all around looking at crappy furniture. But people who buy used stuff from like Craigslist ad and garage sales can essentially make the equivalent of hundreds of dollars per hour, because those few hours you spend doing that can save you thousands. That in itself may or may not be critical, but that's a symptom. That's emblematic. It's a marker for the kind of mindset that often it takes to have good enough cash flow so that you do stay in business and make and become profitable. Number question six. If you owned a store that sold eyeglass frames, you would most likely buy them from A, manufacturer in a low-cost country, B, a U.S. manufacturer, C, a wholesaler whose sales rep called and then visited you, or D, Costco. These are, you know, like in many quizzes or whatever, they're arguable, but in my judgment, the difference in eyeglass frame quality, if you do a little vetting, is not that great that you need to pay for a brand name or designer name. Yes, there are some schmucks who will, customers who will pay $300 for a stupid, you know, designer label on the stupid frame. It's still the same crappy pot metal that was made in China probably anyway. And the main thing you're paying for is the license fee for Gloria Vanderbilt or whatever the heck the name is. But if you're trying to really make money and have margins, the smart thing would be for you to search first on the internet for manufacturers of eyeglass frames in China, or, yeah, probably China, and deal directly, if you can, with the manufacturer. Not always possible, but it's another marker for the kind of business that's likely to succeed. So often I see people think, you know, who run a business say, oh, yeah, I got it for like 50% off of the retail price. That was great. Successful businesses realize that generally you have to buy it for less than 10% of the retail price to make a good living at it. And in fact, with eyeglass frames, the smart way you think is, what must this cost to manufacture? It's cheap plastic. It's cheap pot metal. The only reason it can command a high price is because somehow the idiotic public associates eyeglass frames with eyeglasses, medical, and also the insurance thing, because insurance always drives up the price of everything. So, but you, as a successful business person, need to think, start from zero. What must this cost to manufacture? And then see, okay, it's just cheap plastic. Probably cost them 10 cents to make. So I want to pay a dollar. If I can't get it for a dollar, pay two. But don't listen to the sales guy, the manufacturer's rep who comes in and says, oh, these can retail for $200. We'll sell them to you for $100. Garbage. Makes sense? That's thinking like a business person. Question seven. How confident are you that you would devote the usually required 10 to 30 hours a week on marketing, especially in the business's first year or three? Most people like the idea of running the business, but they don't like marketing. They like helping. They like selling the product, making the product. But the dirty, dark secret is that, especially in the first year, two or three, unless you know you're very lucky, you have the brilliant idea, or you're just magical, you've got to spend a lot of time marketing. If you were, for example, an optometrist, you probably do need to give talks at senior citizen facilities or write articles for a publication read by seniors or schmooze with people who could refer people to you, opticians or whatever. Nobody goes into optometry saying that's why they want to do it, but if you really want to make a living, that's the kind of crap you normally have to do. Number eight, even one-person businesses usually require significant paperwork, bill paying, bill collecting, answering emails, government forms, insurance forms. How likely are you to keep up with all that and or to afford hiring somebody, not too expensively, to do that work? Very likely, quite likely, moderately likely, not likely. Question nine. Every business has problems that arise. Technical problems, computer stuff, human problems, workers who are unreliable, workers who are threatening to sue you, all of that stuff seeing you as having the deep pockets. Logistical problems, mishaps of all stripes. If you too frequently have to hire somebody to solve your problems, your profits can go into the toilet very quickly. How confident are you in your ability to solve those kind of problems by yourself in a timely manner? A, very likely. B, quite likely. C, moderately likely. D, not likely. Question 10. Many one-person businesses, especially service businesses, can be started for very little, especially if it's a home-based business. Of course, the business you choose to start costs a lot more. Opening a cafe could easily cost six figures. How confident are you that you have the capital to start your business, plus the operating capital to keep it running for the months or even year or two it may take to become profitable? Now, you don't need to have the cash yourself. You could borrow it on your no-interest credit card. You can borrow from your Uncle Ernie. You can get an SBA loan, especially if you're a woman or minority. But the question is, given your situation, how likely are you to have the money to get the money to start and operate your business? Very likely, quite likely, moderately likely, or minimally? Question 11 out of the 14 questions in the Should You Be Self-Employed survey. Many one-person businesses or few-person businesses operate at a loss or minimal profit for months or even a year. Can you afford that? Do you have enough savings to do that? A, yes, you can afford it. B, you can afford it with modest strain. C, you can afford it with serious strain. Or D, you can't afford it. Important factor to consider when you're starting a business. Question 12. One more financial question, because money does matter in this in terms of startup. So I've created three questions deliberately on the money side. Question 12. If your business ended up generating little or no profit and you lost all your money that you invested in the business, A, you'd still be able to essentially retain your lifestyle and financial security. B, it would hurt your lifestyle or financial security, but you'd probably be okay. C, it would hurt your lifestyle or financial security, but it wouldn't be devastating. Or D, it would be devastating. By the way, you can probably tell, all the A answers get the most. I can tell you this kind of scoring system now. All the A answers, they get 3 points. All the B answers get 2 points. All the C answers get 1 point. And all the D answers get no points. Right? 13. We get to the world of emotions. The last two questions are about emotions, because emotions matter in this. Facts aside, how worried would you be about your business failing? A, very. B, quite. C, somewhat. D, minimally. Because even if rationally you've got a great business, some people are just too risk averse. They're too worried. It ruins their quality of life so much. You should not be your own boss. You'll hate it. And the final question is just a catch-all question. Overall, how excited are you about the prospect of starting and running a one or perhaps few person business? Very excited, quite excited, moderately excited, not excited. Those are the 14 questions that hopefully will help you determine whether you should start a business or not. And now I want to determine if you should donate to KELW or not. If you listen to Work with Marty Nemco, and you like its practicality, its occasional humor, you're like my wife. You may hate my guts, but you're like my wife, Barbara Nemco, who comes in quite often to give me a hard time. If you like the 3-minute career makeovers, the linchpin of this show is people call in for a 3-minute career makeover. If you like any of those things and you want to support Work with Marty Nemco, this is your last time to do it, I promise. After this, these next few minutes, we will not ask you for money again for 6 months. And it does determine which shows stay on the air and which don't. And if you like Work with Marty Nemco, this is the time to pledge. And to encourage you to do it, we are offering very special thank you gifts. For $75, you get a free autographed copy of my brand new book, How to Do Life, What They Didn't Teach You in School. It's got my best ideas on career, best ideas actually on relationship, on money, and on life's big questions. You know, the meaning of life, all in 130 easy-to-read pages. So you get that. And for $150, you get to come to brunch with Barbara and my wife, Barbara Nemco, and me, and come watch the show on November 11th. It's fun, a great networking opportunity. You can give your input on the show. For all those reasons, if you would like to, this is the time. This is your only, if you want to support Work with Marty Nemco, this is your only time. 1-800-525-9000. 800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or if you prefer, you can certainly go online to kalw.org. If you like the idea of coming to brunch or even making a bigger pledge, some people have paid wanted to pledge $1 a day, $365, or even $1,000, but it's too much to pay at once. We can put it on your credit card, no problem. So cash, credit card, pledges, 1-800-525-9917. If you want to support non-commercial radio, if you don't like the idea of having to listen to commercials every 5 minutes, all year you have none of that from here, from us on public radio, but twice a year we have to come to you to ask for money. But we also were very respectful of your request to keep them short, these pledge breaks. So I'm going to keep it real short. I'll just summarize. If you would like to support work with Marty Nemco and non-commercial public radio, contributing to enlightening the hearts and minds of the public, kalw.org will enable you to do that, kalw.org. Or if 800-525-9917. I'll just repeat one more time. The thank you gifts, $75 gets you a copy of How to Do Life, my new book, What They Didn't Teach You in School, autographed, $150, or $275 for a couple. Come to brunch. We really love meeting you. It's very fun on November 11th. $150 for one, $275 for two, and you get to watch the show if you like. 1-800-525-9917. 1-800-525-9917. And as I promised at the beginning of the show, I have one more kind of a quiz for you. Normally, as you know, I would go to the phones now and ask, do 3-minute career makeovers on callers. Love to help you. But because this is a pledge drive, I can't take calls. So I'm trying to keep things interactive by giving you a quiz. We just did one on should you start a one-person or few-person business. And now I'm going to address a very different kind of issue, one that plagues so many of us, procrastination. So many of us started procrastinating in school. I said, well, I really don't want to write that paper. Oh, I don't want to study for that test, so I'll wait. And you waited till the last second, and the adrenaline motivated you, and lo and behold, you got a good grade. And that, of course, reinforced your desire to procrastinate because you were able to get away with it. But unfortunately, in the real world, especially except at the very lowest levels of employment, the real world is not as tolerant of procrastinators and the lower quality work that accrues as a result. So you can blame school all you want for encouraging your procrastination, but the bottom line is for some of us, not all, but for some of us, procrastination can be a career killer. And so, but for other people, and as I said at the top of the show, John Perry, who is the co-host of Philosophy Talk, the show that precedes this, just wrote a book in defense of procrastination, but that's procrastination has worked for him because he's a brilliant guy who's a professor at Stanford, so he can afford to procrastinate. Most of the rest of us are not quite as fortunate. I want you to help. I'm going to give you this 5-question quiz now to help you assess the extent to which you need to or want to take some additional steps to reduce or eliminate. You can't really eliminate, but manage your procrastination. Procrastination, I view it like almost like high blood pressure. You can't cure it, but you can manage it well enough. And that's what we're talking about. Should you essentially take the pill to manage your procrastination? Okay. All right. Question one. How often does your procrastination increase your anxiety in excess of the benefits you derive? I want to say that in other words. Sometimes, you know, it's a relief, of course, to not have to do that yucky task you didn't want to do. It feels good. Oh, I don't have to work on my taxes. Oh, I don't have to work on that report. Oh, I don't have to call that yucky client. It feels great, of course. But so often, you pay a big price. You feel guilty or worried. Oh, my God, no, I didn't do that. Now I've got 7 calls I got to make. I didn't answer my emails yesterday. Now I'm going to answer 200 emails. Oh, God. And so for some people, the anxiety that comes far exceeds the good feeling that comes from procrastinating. So I'll ask you that question again. For you, question one, how often does your procrastination increase your anxiety in excess of the benefit you derive? A, often. B, sometimes. C, rarely. D, Never. And again, you might want to pull out a little piece of paper. It might help you score. By the way, each of these questions, I should give you the scoring key in advance. Every question you answer A to is 4 points. Every question you answer B is 3 points. Every question you answer C is 2 points. And every question you answer D is one. I suppose we could do it 3, 2, 1, and 0, but whatever. I leave that to you. Question number two on the Is Your Procrastination Hurting You quiz, inventory, whatever you want to call it. How often does your procrastination significantly hurt the quality of your work products? Right? The quality report, the quality of presentation, the quality of your sales pitch, the quality of the work that you do. Again, I'll read it again. How often does your procrastination significantly hurt the quality of your work products? A, often. B, sometimes. C, rarely. And D, never. Question three. How much has your procrastination overall hurt your career? I gave two examples. One is your work product, one increase your anxiety, but there are many other ways that procrastination can hurt your career, or really you have no effect. Maybe you're smart enough and good enough of a BS artist to get by just fine and you feel great about it. That happens. I know people like that. But not everybody. How much has your procrastination hurt your career? A, greatly, if you're really being honest with yourself. B, moderately. C, a bit. Or D, not at all. Question four on the Is Your Procrastination Hurting You inventory. How often does your procrastination frustrate your family and friends? Right? We all know people whose spouses want to kill their spouse for not cleaning out the garage or not paying the bills or not or doing so badly in their career as a result of their procrastination drives them crazy. It's led to more than one divorce. So how often does your procrastination frustrate your family and friends? A, often. B, sometimes. C, rarely. D, never. Last and final question of the five question, Is Your Procrastination Hurting You quiz or inventory? How much has your procrastination hurt your performance in school and college? That's where we tend to learn to start as procrastinating. A lot of you are in school. It doesn't have to be formally going back for a degree, but you may be in a certificate program or a training program that's offered by your professional association. How much has your procrastination hurt your performance in school and college? Maybe it resulted in a low GPA, or your high school procrastination results in you getting into a non-designer label college, which in our crazy designer label society, we value degrees from designer label institutions. How much has your procrastination hurt your performance in school and colleges? A, greatly. B, moderately. C, a bit. D, not at all. So those are the five questions. If you found yourself feeling that pretty much that your procrastination has had a significant deleterious effect on your career and personal life, now we get to what, if anything, do you want to do about it? Or you want to think about it later and come back to it later. But for the moment, assuming that you want to address it now, which of the following feels like something you might want to do to try to address it? Number one, get a loving taskmaster to be on your ass. Because sometimes you can't do it by yourself. You need somebody who is a professional nag or a personal nag, whether it's hiring somebody for $10 an hour or your spouse or girlfriend or whatever, or your boss, saying you need more deadlines, you need to be held on a little tighter leash. Should that be something you do? Is it your fear of failure that is making you procrastinate so much? Sometimes it is. And recognizing that you guarantee failure when you don't try. And you at least have some chance of success if you do try. And the less you try, the more you're likely to fail. Realizing you can survive failure. That you're not that important. If you don't think you're the greatest thing in the world. So let's say you do suffer from poor self-esteem for some failures. Some of the most successful people I know are tortured by lack of self-esteem. People, I've talked about this before, people like Abraham Lincoln and George Washington and Thomas Edison suffered painfully from low self-esteem. And in fact, most of the very successful people I know are not complacent. They're always worried that they're not good enough. They feel like they're imposters, that they've been BSing their way. And those are some of the most successful people of all. So certainly you can afford to fail some and embrace failure. That's often a prerequisite to success. So is your fear of failure causal of why you've been procrastinating? And do you need to address that cause? Do you need to do the time-honored act of taking a big, enormous task that looks like a huge mountain that you're just overwhelmed by and simply breaking it down to baby steps? And if you don't know how to break it down to baby steps, which is very often the problem, find somebody really smart or knowledgeable in your area to help you break it down into a set of baby steps forward. Is it a matter simply of some very low-level behavioral techniques like give yourself the one-second task? Say, okay, the task is huge, but I'm just going to put my butt in the chair. That's a one-second task. It's not intimidating. And then I'm going to give myself the next one-second task. Turn on the computer. Read this page, whatever. Is it sometimes tricking yourself with stuff like the one-second task or what I call the one-minute struggle? One of the reasons that people procrastinate so much is because they feel like they're going to reach a hard part and then they're going to sit and struggle, stuck, making no progress for an hour, 2 hours, and they're going to feel like crap and make no progress. Well, most times, if you haven't made progress within 1 minute over a hard part, you're not going to. At that point, decide, okay, I'm going to get help or I'm going to come back to it later. That's okay to procrastinate at that point. But the one-minute struggle, keeping yourself to struggling with a particular roadblock for 1 minute, can often be very helpful. So, to summarize, I've given you a 5-question quiz or inventory on, is your procrastination hurting you, or is it something you can just accept as part of you? We all procrastinate somewhat. I procrastinate doing my taxes. I hate doing my taxes. But is it really hurting you? If it is, I've offered you a few suggestions for what you might do now to take a baby step toward managing it a little better. Hopefully that's helpful. If you did find it helpful, if you do find work with Marty Nemco helpful, this is the last time. I'm looking at the clock. There's 5 minutes left in the show. And the 5 minutes left in your, for you, it is there. You have 5 minutes to show your support for work with Marty Nemco. There is a $250 challenge that that has come in. If you pledge up to $250, it will be matched by another KLW listener. If you pledge $75, you will get a free copy of my book, How to Do Life. Every dollar you pledge during these next 5 minutes, and only these next 5 minutes, this is the Procrastinator Special. If you've been procrastinating supporting public radio or work with Marty Nemco, this truly is your last time to do it, because every dollar you pledge for the next 4 minutes is a dollar of support for work with Marty Nemco. It's your only chance to get an autographed copy of my new book, How to Do Life, What They Didn't Teach You in School, or for $150, and I swear, I've done this before, everybody who's come to the brunch before says it was great, really great, and really worth it. So for $150 or $275 for a couple, you can come to brunch with Barbara and me on November 11th, and at the same time, watch the show right before we have the brunch. 1-800-525-9917 is the number to call if you'd like to take advantage of the Procrastinator Special and support work with Marty Nemco and Public Radio KALW. 1-800-525-9917, or if you prefer to donate online, www.kalw.org. KALW.org. Maybe I should tell you just a little bit about what goes on at the brunch. People come at 10:45 in the morning. I welcome them into the studio. They sit around. They meet Barbara. We chat a little. They watch Barbara and me do our little last-minute preparations for the show. And then they watch us during the show. Barbara and I do all kinds of interesting things, visually to cue each other. It's very fun. People say it's very fun to watch the show. Then right after the show's over at noon, we go into the green room here at KALW, and I bring in from some wonderful stuff, really a whole buffet, You know, you can't have a New York Jewish guy come in and not really provide lots of food. So I provide lots of food, and we go around the table, and we either share what we want to get from each other, networking-wise, or tips that they want to offer on what they'd like to see more of in the show, and we simply just have fun. It is a great time. So if you would like to be, and it's not a cattle call. It's like usually like 10 people at the brunch. It's not some big thing. If you would like to have brunch with Barbara and me, see, she's the pretty one, I'm the ugly one. See us both. 1-800-525-9917, 150 for one person, 275 for two. You're truly your last chance if you want to support work with Marty Nemco. 1-800-525-9917 or KALW.org. Like I said, we now have just about 1 minute left, and so I would love to give you more content, but I'm just going to ask you again to really be the procrastinator. Especially the other thing that I want to mention is this. I want to remind you of the pledge, the challenge. If you pledge up to $250, it will be matched by a generous KALW donor, so you get that benefit. This is really kind of a unique opportunity. How to do life, what they didn't teach you in school, $75. 1-800-525-9917. Brunch, $150 for a person, $275 for two for with brunch with Barbara and me, and come see the show. 1-800-525-9917. And I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to end this by simply saying thank you. You know, whether or not you can afford to pledge, whether you pledge $25 or $1,000, doesn't matter really in some sense. If you pledge zero, it is a privilege. I'm now finishing my 23rd year here on KALW. And there are a few things that have been a greater privilege than to try to serve you, my listeners, especially in these terribly tight times, to try to land a job in this market. So I'm not going to ask for any more money. I'm going to ask you for, I'll just say thank you to you. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will revert back to normal, and I will do 3-minute career makeovers on callers. That's one of my main purposes here, to help you in these terribly difficult times. And I'm going to explore both sides of a very interesting, controversial issue, which is another thing I try to do on the show. Should underrepresentation of minorities in the workplace be considered legal evidence that the employer is guilty of racial discrimination? For example, let's say in a physics department, there are few African Americans. Is that evidence of racism? I will do my very best to present both sides of that issue. It's called the disparate impact theory. The Department of Justice is using it in a greatly expanded way. I will also, after presenting the pros and cons, ask you to weigh in. I'm excited about that show next week. I hope you'll tune in. In any event, 1-800-525-9917 if you'd like to support Work with Marty Nemco. This is your very last chance to do it, or KALW.org. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.